Exhibiting an unveiled body becomes an art show. American burlesque has turned undressing into a stage show. Nudity is chaste, proclaim those old gentlemen who collect obscene photographs in the name of artistic nudes. In the brothel, the moment of choice begins as a display. If choosing is more complicated, tableau vivant and artistic poses are offered to the client. The prostitute who wishes to acquire a singular distinction does not limit herself to showing her flesh passively. She tries to have her own talents. Greek flute-playing women charmed men with their music and dances. The ouled nails performing belly dances and Spanish women dancing and singing in the barrio chino are simply offering themselves in a refined manner to enthusiasts. Nana goes on stage to find herself a protector. Some music halls, like some concert cafes before them, are simply brothels. All occupations where a woman displays herself can be used for amatory purposes. Of course, there are showgirls, taxi dancers, nude dancers, escorts, pinups, models, singers, and actresses who do not let their sexual lives interfere with their occupations. The more skill and invention involved in their work, the more it can be taken as a goal in itself. But a woman who goes on stage to earn a living is often tempted to use her charms for more intimate commercial ends. Inversely, the courtesan wishes to have an occupation that will serve as her alibi. Rare are those like Colette's Lea, who, addressed by a friend as dear artist, would respond, "Artist? My lovers are truly most indiscreet." We have said that her reputation confers a market value on her. The stage or screen where she makes a name for herself will become her capital. Cinderella does not always dream of Prince Charming. Husband or lover, she fears he may change into a tyrant. She prefers to dream of her own smiling face on a movie theater marquee. But it is more often thanks to her masculine protection that she will attain her goal. And it is men, husbands, lovers, suitors, who confirm her triumph by letting her share their fortune or their fame. It is this need to please another or a crowd that connects the movie star to the hetaira. They play a similar role in society. I will use the word hetaira to designate women who use not only their bodies, but also their entire person as exploitable capital. Their attitude is very different from that of a creator who, transcending himself in a work, goes beyond the given and appeals to a freedom in others to whom he opens up the future. The hetaira does not uncover the world. She opens no road to human transcendence. On the contrary, she seeks to take possession of it for her profit. Note, it may happen that she is also an artist, and seeking to please, she invents and creates. She can either combine these two functions or go beyond the amatory level and class herself in the category of actress, opera singer, dancer, and so on, which will be discussed later. Offering herself for the approval of her admirers, she does not disavow this passive femininity that dooms her to man. She endows it with a magic power that allows her to take males into the trap of her presence and to feed herself on them. She engulfs them with herself in imminence. In this way, woman succeeds in acquiring a certain independence. Giving herself to many men, she belongs to none definitively. The money she accumulates, the name she launches as one launches a product, ensure her economic autonomy. The freest women in ancient Greece were neither matrons nor common prostitutes, but hetairas. Renaissance courtesans and Japanese geishas enjoy an infinitely greater freedom than their contemporaries. In France, the woman who seems to be the most virile and independent is perhaps Ninon de l'Enclos. Paradoxically, those women who exploit their femininity to the extreme create a situation for themselves nearly equal to that of a man. Moving from this sex that delivers them to men as objects, they become subjects. They not only earn their living like men, but also live in nearly exclusively masculine company. Free in their mores and speech, they can rise to the rarest intellectual freedom. Like Ninon de l'Enclos, the most distinguished among them are often surrounded with artists and writers who find virtuous women boring. Masculine myths find their most seductive incarnation in the Hetaira. More than any other woman, she is flesh and consciousness. Idol, inspiration, muse, painters and sculptors want her as their model. She will nourish poets' dreams. It is in her that the intellectual will explore the treasures of feminine intuition. She is more readily intelligent than the matron because she is less set in hypocrisy. Women who are extremely talented will not readily settle for the role of Egeria. They will feel the need to show autonomously the value that the admiration of others confers on them. They will try to transform their passive virtues into activities. Emerging in the world as sovereign subjects, they write poems, prose, they paint and compose music. Thus, Imperia became famous among Italian courtesans. A woman might also use man as an instrument, so as to practice through him masculine functions. The favorite royal mistresses participated in the government of the world through their powerful lovers. Note, just as some women use marriage to serve their own ends, others use their lovers as means for attaining a political or economic aim. They go beyond the Hetaira's situation as others go beyond the matron's. This liberation can be conveyed on the erotic level as well. Woman might find compensation for the feminine inferiority complex in the money and services she extorts from man. Money has a purifying role. It abolishes the war of the sexes. If many non-professional women insist on extracting checks and gifts from their lovers, making the man pay, and paying him, as we will see further on, it is not out of cupidity alone. It is to change him into an instrument. In that way, the woman defends herself from becoming one herself. Perhaps he believes he has her, but this sexual possession is illusory. It is she who has him on the far more solid economic ground. Her self-esteem is satisfied. She can abandon herself to her lover's embraces. She is not yielding to a foreign will. Pleasure will not be inflicted on her. It will become rather a supplementary benefit. She will not be taken because she is paid. Nevertheless, the courtesan has the reputation of being frigid. It is useful for her to know how to govern her heart and her sexual appetite. Sentimental or sensual, she risks being under the influence of a man who will exploit or dominate her, or make her suffer. Among the sexual acts she accepts, there are many, especially early in her career, that humiliate her. Her revolt against male arrogance is expressed by her frigidity. Hetairas, like matrons, freely confide tricks to each other that enable them to fake their work. This contempt, this disgust for men, clearly shows they are not at all sure they have won the game of exploiter-exploited. And in fact, in the great majority of cases, dependence is still their lot. No man is their definitive master, but they have the most urgent need of man. The courtesan loses all her means of existence if he ceases to desire her. The novice knows that her whole future is in his hands. Deprived of masculine support, even the movie star sees her prestige fade. Abandoned by Orson Welles, Rita Hayworth wandered over Europe like a sickly orphan until she found Ali Khan. The most beautiful woman is never sure of tomorrow, because her weapons are magic, and magic is capricious. She is bound to her protector, husband or lover, nearly as tightly as a virtuous wife is bound to her husband. She not only owes him bed service, but also is subjected to his presence, conversation, friends, and especially his vanity's demands. By paying for his studies, high heels, and satin skirts, the pimp makes an investment that will bring a return. By offering his girlfriend pearls and furs, the industrialist or the producer displays his wealth and power through her. Whether the woman is a means for earning money or a pretext for spending it, it is the same servitude. The gifts showered on her are chains. And are these clothes and jewels she wears really hers? The man sometimes reclaims them after they break up, as Sasha Guitry once did with Elegance. To keep her protector without renouncing her pleasures, The woman uses ruses, maneuvers, lies, and hypocrisy that dishonor conjugal life. Even if she only feigns servility, this game is itself servile. Beautiful and famous, she can choose another if the master of the moment becomes odious. But beauty is a worry, a fragile treasure. The hetaira is totally dependent on her body, which time pitilessly degrades. The fight against aging is most dramatic for her. If she is endowed with great prestige, she will be able to survive the ruin of her face and figure. But caring for this renown, her surest asset, subjects her to the hardest of tyrannies, that of public opinion. We know that Hollywood stars fall into slavery. Their bodies are no longer their own. The producer decides on their hair color, weight, figure, and type. Teeth are pulled out to change the shape of a cheek. Diets, exercise, fittings, and makeup are daily chores. Going out and flirting are part of personal appearances. Private life is just a moment in their public life. In France, there is no written contract, but a careful and clever woman knows what promotion demands of her. The star who refuses to give in to these demands will face a brutal or slow but ineluctable decline. The prostitute who only gives her body is perhaps less of a slave than the woman whose occupation it is to entertain. A woman who has arrived through a real profession and whose talent is recognized, actress, opera singer, dancer, escapes the hetaira's condition. She can experience true independence. But most spend their entire lives in danger. They must seduce the public and men over and over without respite. Very often, the kept woman interiorizes her dependence. Subjected to public opinion, she accepts its values. She admires the fashionable world and adopts its customs. She wants to be regarded according to bourgeois standards. She is a parasite of the rich bourgeoisie, and she adheres to its ideas. She is right-thinking. In former times, she would readily send her daughters to a convent school, and as she got older, she even went to mass and openly converted. She is on the conservative side. She is too proud to have made her place in this world to want to change. The struggle she wages to arrive does not dispose her to feelings of brotherhood and human solidarity. She paid for her success with too much slavish compliance to sincerely wish for universal freedom. Zola highlights this trait in Nana. As for books and plays, Nana had very definite opinions. She wanted tender and noble works, things to make her dream and elevate her soul. She was riled up against the Republicans. What on earth did those dirty people who never washed want? Weren't people happy? Didn't the emperor do everything he could for the people? A pretty bit of filth, the people. She knew them. She could talk about them. No, you see, their republic would be a great misfortune for everyone. Oh, may God preserve the emperor as long as possible. In times of war, no one displays a more aggressive patriotism than high-level prostitutes. They hope to rise to the level of duchess through the noble sentiments they affect. Commonplaces, clichés, prejudices, and conventional feelings form the basis of their public conversations, and they have often lost all sincerity deep in their hearts. Between lies and hyperbole, language is destroyed. The hetaira's whole life is a show. Her words, her gestures, are intended not to express her thoughts, but to produce an effect. She plays a comedy of love for her protector. At times, she plays it for herself. She plays comedies of respectability and prestige for the public. She ends up believing herself to be a paragon of virtue and a sacred idol. Stubborn bad faith governs her inner life and permits her studied lies to seem true. There are moments of spontaneity in her life. She does experience love. She has flings and infatuations. Sometimes she is even mad about someone. But the one who spends too much time on caprices, feelings, or pleasure will soon lose her position. Generally, she composes her fantasies with the prudence of an adulterous wife. She hides from her producer and the public. Thus, she cannot give too much of herself to her true loves. They can only be a distraction, a respite. Besides, she is usually too obsessed with her own success to be able to lose herself in a real love affair. As for other women, it often happens that the hetera loves them sensually. As an enemy of men who impose their domination on her, she will find sensual relaxation as well as revenge in the arms of a woman friend. So it was with Nana and her dear Satin. Just as she wishes to play an active role in the world, to put her freedom to positive use, she likes to possess other beings, very young men whom she enjoys helping, or young women she will willingly support, and, in any case, for whom she will be a virile personage. Whether she is homosexual or not, she will have the complex relations I have discussed with women in general. She needs them as judges and witnesses, as confidants and accomplices, to create this counter-universe that every woman oppressed by man must have. But feminine rivalry reaches its paroxysm here. The prostitute who trades on her generality has competition. But if there is enough work for everyone, they feel solidarity, even with their disputes. The hetera who seeks to distinguish herself is a priori hostile to the one who, like her, lusts for a privileged place. This is where the well-known theme of feminine cattiness proves true. The greatest misfortune for the hetera is that not only is her independence the deceptive reverse side of 1,000 dependencies, but this very freedom is negative. An actress like Rochelle, a dancer like Isadora Duncan, even if they are aided by men, have occupations that are demanding and justify them. They attain concrete freedom from the work they choose and love. But for the great majority of them, their art, their occupations, are only a means. They are not involved in real projects. Cinema, in particular, which subjects the star to the director, allows her no invention, no progress in creative activity. Others exploit what she is. She does not create a new object. Still, it is quite rare to become a star. In amorous adventures, properly speaking, no road opens onto transcendence. Here again, ennui accompanies the confinement of woman in imminence. Zola shows this with Nana. However, in the midst of all this luxury, and surrounded by her courtiers, Nana was bored to tears. She had men for every minute of the night, and money all over the house, even among the brushes and combs in the drawers of her dressing table. But all this had ceased to satisfy her, and she was conscious of a void in her existence, a gap which made her yawn. Her life dragged on without occupation, each day bringing back the same monotonous hours. The next day did not exist. She lived like a bird, sure of having enough to eat, and ready to perch on the first branch she came to. This certainty of being fed caused her to stretch out in languid ease all day, lulled to sleep in conventional idleness and submission, as if she were the prisoner of her own profession. Never going out except in her carriage, she began to lose the use of her legs. She reverted to her childish habits, kissing bijou from morning to night, and killing time with stupid pleasures, as she waited for some man or other. American literature abounds with this opaque ennui that stifles Hollywood and chokes the traveler as soon as he arrives there. Actors and extras are as bored as the women whose condition they share. Even in France, official events are often burdensome. The protector who rules the starlet's life is an older man whose friends are his age. Their preoccupations are foreign to the young woman. Their conversations weary her. There is a chasm far deeper than in bourgeois marriages between the 20-year-old novice and the 45-year-old banker who spend their days and nights side by side. The Malik to whom the hetera sacrifices pleasure, love, and freedom is her career. The matron's ideal is static happiness that envelops her relations with her husband and children. Her career stretches across time, but it is nonetheless an imminent object that is summed up in a name. The name gets bigger on billboards and on people's lips as the steps mounted up the social ladder get higher. According to her temperament, the woman administers her enterprise prudently or boldly. One woman will find satisfaction in housekeeping, folding laundry in her closet. the other in the headiness of adventure. Sometimes the woman limits herself to perpetually balancing a perpetually threatened situation that sometimes breaks down, or sometimes she endlessly builds, like a Tower of Babel, aiming in vain for the sky, her renown. Some of them, mixing amorous commerce with other activities, are true adventurers. They are spies, like Matahari, or secret agents. They generally are not the ones who initiate the projects. They are rather instruments in men's hands. But overall, the Hetaira's attitude is similar to that of the adventurer. Like him, she is often halfway between the serious and the adventure as such. She seeks ready-made values, money and glory, but she attaches as much value to winning them as to possessing them. And finally, the supreme value in her eyes is subjective success. She too justifies this individualism by a more or less systematic nihilism, but experienced with all the more conviction as she is hostile to men and sees enemies in other women. If she is intelligent enough to feel the need for moral justification, she will invoke a more or less well-assimilated Nietzscheism. She will affirm the right of the elite being over the vulgar. Her person belongs to her like a treasure whose mere existence is a gift. So much so that in being dedicated to herself, she will claim to serve the group. The destiny of the woman devoted to man is haunted by love. She who exploits the male fulfills herself in the cult of self-adoration. If she attaches such a price to her glory, it is not only for economic interest. She seeks there the apotheosis of her narcissism. Chapter 9. From Maturity to Old Age. The history of woman, because she is still trapped in her female functions, depends much more than man's on her physiological destiny. And the arc of this destiny is more erratic, more discontinuous than the masculine one. Every period of woman's life is fixed and monotonous, but the passages from one stage to another are dangerously abrupt. They reveal themselves in far more decisive crises than those of the male. Puberty, sexual initiation, menopause. While the male grows older continuously, the woman is brusquely stripped of her femininity. Still young, she loses sexual attraction and fertility, from which, in society's and her own eyes, she derives the justification of her existence and her chances of happiness. Bereft of all future, she has approximately half of her adult life still to live. The dangerous age is characterized by certain organic troubles, but the symbolic value they embody gives them their importance. Note, refer to Volume 1, Chapter 1, in Part 1, Destiny, Translation. The crisis is felt much less acutely by women who have not essentially staked everything on their femininity. Those who work hard, in their home or outside, are relieved when their menstrual servitude ends. Peasants and workers' wives who are constantly threatened with new pregnancies are happy when, finally, that risk no longer exists. In this situation, as in many others, women's disorders come less from the body itself than from their anxious consciousness of it. The moral drama usually begins before the onset of the physiological phenomena, and it does not end until long after they have been eliminated. Well before the definitive mutilation, woman is haunted by the horror of aging. The mature man is engaged in more important enterprises than those of love. His sexual ardor is less pressing than in his youth, and as he is not expected to have the passive qualities of an object, the alteration of his face and body does not spoil his possibilities of seduction. By contrast, woman reaches her full sexual blossoming at about 35. Having finally overcome all her inhibitions, this is when her desires are the most intense and when she wants to satisfy them the most ardently. She has counted on her sexual attributes far more than man has. To keep her husband, to be assured of protection, and to succeed in most jobs she holds, she has to please. She has not been allowed a hold on the world, except through man's mediation. What will become of her when she no longer has a hold on him? This is what she anxiously wonders while she witnesses, powerless, the degradation of this object of flesh with which she is one. She fights, but dyes, peeling, and plastic surgery can never do more than prolong her dying youth. At least she can play tricks with the mirror. But when the inevitable, irreversible process starts, which is going to destroy in her the whole edifice constructed during puberty, she feels touched by the very inevitability of death. One might think that the woman who experiences the greatest distress is the one who has been the most passionately enraptured by her beauty and youth. But no. The narcissist is too attentive to her person not to have envisaged the ineluctable moment and not to have worked out an alternative position. She will certainly suffer from her mutilation, but at least she will not be caught short and will adapt rather quickly. The woman who has forgotten, devoted, and sacrificed herself will be disrupted much more by the sudden revelation. I had only one life to live. This was my lot, so here I am. To the surprise of her family and friends, a radical change takes place in her. Expelled from her shelter, torn away from her projects, she brusquely finds herself without resources, face to face with herself. Beyond this barrier she has unexpectedly struck, she has the feeling that she will do no more than survive. Her body will be without promise. The dreams and desires she has not realized will forever remain unaccomplished. She will look back on the past from this new perspective. The time has come to draw the line, to take stock. And she is horrified by the narrow strictures inflicted on her life. Faced with this, her brief and disappointing story, she behaves like an adolescent girl on the threshold of a still inaccessible future. She denies her finitude. To the poverty of her existence, she contrasts the nebulous treasures of her personality. Because as a woman she endured her destiny more or less passively, she feels that her chances were taken from her, that she was duped, that she slid from youth to maturity without being aware of it. She discovers that her husband, her milieu, and her occupations were not worthy of her. She feels misunderstood. She withdraws from the surroundings to which she esteems herself superior. She shuts herself up with the secret she carries in her heart, and which is the mysterious key to her unfortunate lot. She tries to see the possibilities she has not exhausted. She begins to keep a diary. If she has understanding confidants, she pours out her heart in endless conversations, and she ruminates on her regrets, her grievances, all day and all night. Just as the young girl dreams of what her future will be, she recalls what her past could have been. She remembers the missed occasions and constructs beautiful retrospective romances. Helena Deutsch cites the case of a woman who had broken off an unhappy marriage very early and who had then spent long, serene years with a second husband. At 45, she painfully began to miss her first husband and to sink into melancholy. The cares of childhood and puberty come back to life. The woman constantly mulls over the story of her youth and forgotten feelings for her parents, brothers and sisters, and childhood friends come alive once again. Sometimes she indulges in dreamy and passive moroseness, but more often she is jolted into saving her wasted existence. She displays, exhibits, and praises the merits of this personality she has just discovered in contrast with the pettiness of her destiny. Matured by experience, she believes she is finally able to prove her worth. She would like to have another chance. And first, in a pathetic effort, she tries to stop time. A maternal woman is sure she can still have a child. She passionately seeks to create life once more. A sensual woman strives to conquer a new lover. The coquette is more than ever determined to please. They all declare they have never felt so young. They want to persuade others that the passage of time has not really touched them. They begin to dress young. They act childishly. The aging woman well knows that if she has ceased being a sexual object, It is not only because her flesh no longer provides man with fresh treasures. It is also that her past and her experience make a person of her whether she likes it or not. She has fought, loved, wanted, suffered, and taken pleasure for herself. This autonomy is intimidating. She tries to disavow it. She exaggerates her femininity. She adorns herself, wears perfume. She becomes totally charming, gracious, pure eminence. She admires her male interlocutor with a naive eye and childish intonations. She ostentatiously brings up her memories of girlhood. Instead of speaking, she chirps, claps her hands, bursts out laughing. She plays this game with a kind of sincerity. This newfound interest in herself and her desire to wrench herself from old routines and start over again give her the impression of a new beginning. In fact, it is not really a question of a new start. She discovers no goals in the world toward which she could project herself in a free and effective movement. Her agitation is more eccentric, incoherent, and useless, because it only serves as symbolic compensation for past errors and failures. Among other things, and before it is too late, the woman will try to realize all her childhood and adolescent desires. This one goes back to the piano. That one begins to sculpt, to write, to travel. She takes up skiing, foreign languages. She welcomes everything she had refused until then. Again, before it is too late. She admits her repugnance for a husband she had previously tolerated, and she becomes frigid in his arms. Or by contrast, she abandons herself to the passions she repressed. She overwhelms the husband with her demands. She goes back to practicing masturbation, which she had given up since childhood. Her homosexual tendencies, which are latent in almost all women, come out. The subject often carries them over to her daughter, but sometimes unusual feelings arise for a woman friend. In his work, Sex, Life, and Faith, Rahm Landau tells the following story, confided to him by the person herself. Mrs. X, a woman in the late 40s, married for over 25 years, mother of 3 grown-up children, occupied a prominent position in the social and charitable activities of the town in which she lived. Mrs. X met a woman in London, some 10 years her junior, who, like herself, was a leading social worker. The two became friends. Miss Y invited Mrs. X to stay as her guest during her next visit to London, and Mrs. X accepted. During the second evening of her visit, Mrs. X assured me repeatedly that she had not the least idea how it happened, she suddenly found herself passionately embracing her hostess, and subsequently she spent the whole night with her. She was terrified and left London the same day. Never in her life had she read or heard anything about homosexuality and had had no idea that such things existed. She could do nothing to stifle her ever-growing feelings for Miss Y. For the first time in her life, she found her husband's caresses unwelcome, even his routine kiss. Finally, she decided to revisit Miss Y and clear up the situation. She only found herself more deeply involved in it. To be with her filled her with a delight that she had never experienced before. She was troubled by a profound sin consciousness and was anxious to discover whether there was a scientific explanation of her state and any moral justification for it. In this case, the subject gave in to a spontaneous drive and was herself deeply disconcerted by it. But often the woman deliberately seeks to live the romances she has not experienced and that soon she will no longer be able to experience. She leaves her home both because it seems unworthy of her and because she desires solitude as well as the chance to seek adventure. If she finds it, she throws herself into it greedily. Thus, in this story by Stekel, Mrs. BZ was 40 years old, had 3 children and 20 years of married life behind her when she began to think she was misunderstood, that she had wasted her life. She took up various new activities, among which was going skiing in the mountains. There she met a 30-year-old man and became his mistress. But soon after, he fell in love with Mrs. BZ's daughter, She agreed to their marriage so as to keep her lover near her. There was an unacknowledged but very strong homosexual love between mother and daughter, which partially explains this decision. Nevertheless, the situation soon became intolerable, the lover sometimes leaving the mother's bed during the night to be with the daughter. Mrs. BZ attempted suicide. It was then, she was 46, that she was treated by Stekel. She decided to break it off, and while her daughter gave up her marriage plans, Mrs. BZ then became an exemplary wife and fell into piousness. A woman influenced by a tradition of decency and honesty does not always follow through with action, but her dreams are peopled with erotic fantasies that she calls up during waking hours as well. She manifests an exalted and sensual tenderness to her children. She cultivates incestuous obsessions with her son. She secretly falls in love with one young man after another. Like an adolescent girl, she is haunted by ideas of rape. She also feels the attraction of prostitution. The ambivalence of her desires and fears produces an anxiety that sometimes leads to neuroses. She scandalizes her family and friends by bizarre behavior that, in fact, merely expresses her imaginary life. The boundary between the imaginary and the real is even less distinct in this troubled period than during puberty. One of the most salient characteristics in the aging woman is the feeling of depersonalization that makes her lose all objective landmarks. People in good health who have come close to death also say they have felt a curious impression of doubling. When one feels oneself to be consciousness, activity, and freedom, the passive object affected by fate seems necessarily like another. I am not the one run over by a car. I am not the old woman the mirror shows me. The woman who never felt so young and who never saw herself so old is not able to reconcile these two aspects of herself. Time passes and diminishes her in dreams, so reality fades and becomes less important. Likewise, she can no longer tell herself apart from the illusion. The woman relies on interior proof rather than on this strange world where time proceeds in reverse, where her double no longer resembles her, where events have betrayed her. She is thus inclined to ecstasies, visions, and deliriums. And since love is even more than ever her essential preoccupation, it is understandable that she lets herself go to the illusion that she is loved. 9 out of 10 erotomaniacs are women, and they are almost all between 40 and 50 years old. However, not everyone is able to cross over the wall of reality so boldly. Deprived of all human love, even in their dreams, many women seek relief in God. The flirt, the lover, and the dissolute become pious around menopause. The vague ideas of destiny, secrecy, and misunderstood personality of woman in her autumn years find a rational unity in religion. The devotee considers her wasted life as a test sent by the Lord. In her unhappiness, her soul has drawn exceptional advantages from misfortune, making her worthy of being visited by the grace of God. She will readily believe that heaven sends her illuminations, or even, like Madame Krudener, that it imperiously entrusts her with a mission. As she has more or less lost the sense of reality during this crisis, the woman is open to any suggestion. Any spiritual guide is in a strong position to wield power over her soul. She will also enthusiastically accept more questionable authorities. She is an obvious prey for religious sects, spirits, prophets, faith healers, and any charlatan. Not only has she lost all critical sense by losing contact with the given world, but she is also desperate for a definitive truth. She has to have the remedy, the formula, the key, that will suddenly save her by saving the universe. She scorns more than ever a logic that obviously could not possibly apply to her own case. The only arguments that seem convincing to her are those that are particularly destined for her. Revelations, inspirations, messages, signs, or even miracles begin to appear around her. Her discoveries sometimes draw her into paths of action. she throws herself into schemes, undertakings, and adventures, whose idea is whispered to her by some advisor or inner voices. Sometimes she simply deems herself the holder of the truth and absolute wisdom. Whether she is active or contemplative, her attitude is accompanied by feverish exaltation. The crisis of menopause brutally cuts feminine life into two. It is this discontinuity that gives woman the illusion of a new life. It is an other time opening before her. She approaches it with the fervor of a convert. She is converted to love, life, God, art, and humanity. She loses and magnifies herself in these entities. She is dead and resuscitated. She views the earth with a gaze that has pierced the secrets of the beyond, and she thinks she is flying toward uncharted heights. Yet the earth does not change. The summits remain out of reach. The messages received, even in blinding clarity, are hard to decipher. The inner lights go out. What remains before the mirror is a woman one day older than yesterday. Doleful hours of depression follow moments of fervor. The body determines this rhythm since a reduction in hormonal secretions is offset by a hyperactive hypophysis. But it is above all the psychological state that orders this alternation. For the agitation, illusions, and fervor are merely a defense against the inevitability of what has been. Once again, anxiety grabs the throat of the one whose life is already finished, even though death is not imminent. Instead of fighting against despair, she often chooses to intoxicate herself with it. She rehashes grievances, regrets, and recriminations. She imagines that her neighbors and family are engaging in dark machinations. If she has a sister or woman friend of her age who is associated with her life, they may construct persecution fantasies together. But above all, she becomes morbidly jealous of her husband. She is jealous of his friends, his sisters, his job, and rightly or wrongly, she accuses some rival of being responsible for all her problems. Cases of pathological jealousy mostly occur between 50 and 55 years of age. The problems of menopause will last, sometimes until death, if the woman does not decide to let herself grow old. If she does not have any resources other than the use of her charms, she will fight tooth and nail to maintain them. She will also fight with rage if her sex drives remain alive. This is not unusual. Princess Metternich was asked at what age a woman stops being tormented by the flesh. "I don't know," she said. "I'm only 65. Marriage, which Montaigne thought provided little relief for woman, becomes a more and more inadequate solution as a woman gets older. She often pays for the resistance and coldness of her youth in maturity. When she finally begins to experience the fevers of desire, her husband has been resigned to her indifference for a long time. He has found a solution for himself. Stripped of her attraction by habit and time, the wife seldom has the opportunity to awaken the conjugal flame. Vexed, determined to live her life, she will have fewer scruples than before, if she ever had any, in taking lovers. But there again, they have to let themselves be taken. It is a manhunt. She deploys 1,000 ruses, feigning to offer herself, she imposes herself. She uses charm, friendship, and gratitude as traps. It is not only out of a desire for fresh flesh that she goes after young men. They are the only ones from whom she can hope for this disinterested tenderness the adolescent male can sometimes feel for a maternal mistress. She has become aggressive and domineering. Léa is fulfilled by Chéri's docility as well as by his beauty. Once she reached her 40s, Madame de Stael chose pages whom she overwhelmed with her prestige, and a shy man, a novice, is also easier to capture. When seduction and intrigue really prove useless, there is still one resource: paying. The tale of the little knife, popular in the Middle Ages, illustrates these insatiable ogresses' fate. A young woman, as thanks for her favors, asked each of her lovers for a little knife, which she kept in a cupboard. The day came when the cupboard was full, but it was then that the lovers began to demand from her a little knife after each night of love. The cupboard was soon emptied. All the little knives had been returned. Others had to be bought. Some women take a cynical view of the situation. They have had their moment. Now it is their turn to return the little knives. Money, in their eyes, can even play the opposite but equally purifying role of the one it plays for the courtesan. It changes the male into an instrument and provides woman with the erotic freedom that her young pride used to deny her. But more romantic than lucid, the mistress benefactress often attempts to buy a mirage of tenderness, admiration, and respect. She even persuades herself that she gives for the pleasure of giving, without being asked. Here, too, a young man is the perfect choice because a woman can pride herself on maternal generosity toward him. And then there is a little of this mystery. The man also asks of the woman he helps, so that this crude deal is thus camouflaged as enigma. But it is rare for this bad faith to be moderate for long. The battle of the sexes changes into a duel between exploiter and exploited, where woman, disappointed and ridiculed, risks suffering cruel defeats. If she is prudent, she will resign herself to disarming without waiting too long, even if all her passions are not yet spent. From the day woman agrees to grow old, her situation changes. Until then, she was still young, determined to fight against an evil that mysteriously made her ugly and deformed her. Now she becomes a different being, asexual but complete, an elderly woman. It may be thought that the change of life crisis is then finished, but one must not conclude that it will be easy to live from then on. When she has given up the fight against the inevitability of time, another combat opens. She has to keep a place on Earth. Woman frees herself from her chains in her autumn and winter years. She uses the pretext of her age to escape burdensome chores. She knows her husband too well to let herself still be intimidated by him. She avoids his embraces. She carves out, in friendship, indifference, or hostility, a real life of her own alongside him. If he declines more quickly than she takes the lead in the couple. She can also allow herself to disdain fashion and public opinion. She refuses social obligations, diets, and beauty treatment. Like Leia, whom Cheri finds liberated from dressmakers, corset makers, and hairdressers, and happily settled down indulging herself in food. As for her children, they are old enough not to need her. They get married. They leave home. Relieved of her duties, she finally discovers her freedom. Unfortunately, every woman's history repeats the fact we have observed throughout the history of woman. She discovers this freedom when she can find nothing more to do with it. This repetition has nothing coincidental about it. Patriarchal society has made all feminine functions servile. Woman escapes slavery only when she loses all productivity. At 50, she is in full possession of her strength. She feels rich in experience. This is the age when man rises to the highest positions, the most important jobs, and as for her, she is forced into retirement. She has only been taught to devote herself, and there is no one who requires her devotion anymore. Useless, unjustified, she contemplates these long years without promise she still has to live, and murmurs, "No one needs me." She does not resign herself right away. Sometimes, out of despair, she clings to her husband. She overwhelms him more imperiously than ever with her ministrations. But the routine of conjugal life has been too well established. Either she has known for a long time that her husband does not need her, or he does not seem precious enough to her to justify her any longer. Assuring the maintenance of their shared life is as contingent a task as watching over herself alone. She turns to her children with hope. For them, the die is not yet cast. The world, the future, are open to them. She would like to dive into it after them. The woman who has had the chance of giving birth at an advanced age finds herself privileged. She is still a young mother when the others are becoming grandparents. But in general, between 40 and 50, the mother sees her little ones become adults. It is at the very instant they are escaping her that she passionately attempts to live through them. Her attitude is different depending on whether she is counting on being saved by a son or a daughter. She usually puts her strongest hope in her son. Here, he finally comes to her from the far past, the man whose marvelous appearance she waited to see coming over the horizon. From the first scream of the newborn, she has waited for this day, when he will hand out all the treasures the father was never able to satisfy her with. During that time, she has doled out slaps and purges, but she has forgotten them. He whom she carried in her womb was already one of these demigods who governed the world and women's destiny. Now he will recognize her in the glory of her motherhood. He will defend her against her spouse's supremacy, avenge her for the lovers she has had and those she has not had. He will be her liberator, her savior. She will behave like the seductive and ostentatious girl waiting for Prince Charming. When she is walking beside him, elegant and still charming, she thinks she looks like his older sister. She is delighted if, taking after the heroes of American films, he teases and jostles her, laughing and respectful. With proud humility, she recognizes the virile superiority of the one she carried in her womb. To what extent can these feelings be considered incestuous? It is sure that when she thinks of herself complacently on her son's arm, the expression, older sister, prudishly expresses ambivalent fantasies. When she sleeps, when she does not control herself, her musings sometimes carry her very far. But I have already said that dreams and fantasies are far from always expressing the hidden desire of a real act. They are often sufficient. They are the completion of a desire that only requires an imaginary satisfaction. When the mother plays in a more or less veiled way at seeing her son as a lover, it is just a game. Real eroticism usually has little place in this couple. But it is a couple. It is from the depths of her femininity that the mother hails in her son the sovereign man. She puts herself in his hands with as much fervor as a lover, and in exchange for this gift, she counts on being raised to the right hand of the god. To gain this assumption, the woman in love appeals to the lover's freedom. She generously assumes a risk. Her anxious demands are the ransom. The mother reckons she has acquired holy rights by the simple fact of giving birth. She does not expect her son to see himself in her in order for her to consider him her creation, her property. She is less demanding than the woman lover because she is of a more tranquil bad faith. Having made a being of flesh, she makes an existence her own. She appropriates its acts, accomplishments, and merits. In exalting her fruit, she is carrying her own person to the heights. Living by proxy is always a precarious expedient. Things may not turn out as one wished. It often happens that a son is no more than a good-for-nothing, a hooligan, a failure, a lost cause, an empty promise, ungrateful. The mother has her own ideas about the hero her son is supposed to embody. Nothing is rarer than a mother who authentically respects the human person her child is, who recognizes his freedom, even in his failures, who assumes with him the risks implied by any engagement. One more often encounters mothers who emulate that over-glorified Spartan woman who cavalierly condemns her son to glory or death. On earth, the son has to justify his mother's existence by taking hold of values she herself respects for their mutual advantage. The mother demands that the child god's projects conform to her own ideal and that their success be assured. Every woman wants to give birth to a hero, a genius, but all mothers of heroes and geniuses began by proclaiming they were breaking their mother's hearts. It is in reaction to his mother that man most often wins the trophies she dreamed of displaying for herself, and that she does not recognize even when he lays them at her feet. Though she may approve in principle of her son's undertakings, She is torn by a contradiction similar to one that tortures the woman in love. To justify his life and his mother's, the son must surpass her toward his ends, and to attain them, he is led to risk his health and put himself in danger. But he contests the value of the gift she gave him when he places certain goals above the pure fact of living. She is shocked by this. She reigns sovereign over man only if this flesh she has engendered is for him the supreme good. He does not have the right to destroy this work she has produced through suffering. "You'll tire yourself out. You'll make yourself ill. You'll be sorry," she drones in his ears. Yet she knows very well that to live is not enough, or else procreation itself would be superfluous. She is the first to be irritated if her offspring is a loafer, a coward. She is never at rest. When he goes to war, she wants him home alive but decorated. In his career, she wishes him to make it, but trembles when he overworks. Whatever he does, she always worries that she will stand by powerless in the unfolding of a story that is hers, but over which she has no control. She fears he will make the wrong decision, that he will not succeed, that if he succeeds, he will ruin his health. Even if she has confidence in him, differences of age and sex keep a real complicity from being established between her son and her. She is not informed about his work. No collaboration is demanded of her. This is why the mother remains unsatisfied, even if she admires her son with inordinate pride, believing that she has not only engendered a being of flesh, but also founded an absolutely necessary existence. She feels retrospectively justified. But having rights is not an occupation. To fill her days, she needs to perpetuate her beneficent activity. She wants to feel indispensable to her God. The mystification of devotion in this case is denounced in the most brutal manner. His wife will strip her of her functions. The hostility she feels to this stranger who steals her child has often been described. The mother has raised the contingent facticity of parturition to the height of divine mystery. She refuses to accept that a human decision can have more weight. In her eyes, values are pre-established. They proceed from nature, from the past. She does not understand the value of a freely made engagement. Her son owes her his life. What does he owe this woman he did not know until yesterday? It is through some evil spell that she convinced him of the existence of a bond that until now did not exist. She is devious, calculating, and dangerous. The mother impatiently waits for the imposture to be revealed, encouraged by the old myth of the good mother with healing hands who binds the wounds inflicted on him by the bad wife. She watches her son's face for signs of unhappiness. She finds them, even if he denies it. She feels sorry for him, even when he complains of nothing. She spies on her daughter-in-law. She criticizes her. She counters all her innovations with the past and the customs that condemn the intruder's very presence. Each woman understands the beloved's happiness in her own way. The wife wants to see in him a man through whom she will control the world. The mother tries to keep him by taking him back to his childhood. To the projects of the young wife who expects her husband to become rich or important, the mother counters with the laws of his unchanging essence. He is fragile. He must not tire himself. The conflict between the past and the future is exacerbated when it is the newcomer's turn to get pregnant. The birth of children is the death of parents. Here, this truth is at its cruelest. The mother who had hoped to live on through her son understands he has condemned her to death. She gave life. Life will continue without her. She is no longer the mother. Simply a link, she falls from the heaven of timeless idols. She is no more than a finished, outdated individual. It is then that in pathological cases, her hatred intensifies to the point where she has a neurosis or is driven to commit a crime. It was when her daughter-in-law's pregnancy was announced that Madame Lefebvre, who had long hated her, decided to kill her. Note: In August 1925, A 60-year-old bourgeois woman from the north, Madame Lefebvre, who lived with her husband and her children, killed her daughter-in-law, 6 months pregnant, during a car trip while her son was driving. Condemned to death and then pardoned, she spent the rest of her life in a reformatory where she showed no remorse. She believed God approved of her when she killed her daughter-in-law, as one kills a weed, a bad seed, as one kills a savage beast. The only savagery she gave as proof was that the young woman one day said to her, "You have me now, so now you have to take me into account." It was when she suspected her daughter-in-law's pregnancy that she bought a revolver, supposedly to defend herself against robbers. After her menopause, she was desperately attached to her maternity. For 12 years, she had suffered from malaises that manifested themselves symbolically in an imaginary pregnancy. Normally, the grandmother overcomes her hostility. Sometimes she obstinately sees the newborn as her son's alone, and she loves it tyrannically. But generally, the young mother and her own mother claim it for their own. The jealous grandmother cultivates an ambiguous affection for the baby, where hostility hides in the guise of concern. The mother's attitude to her grown daughter is very ambivalent. She seeks a god in her son. In her daughter, she finds a double. The double is an ambiguous personage. It assassinates the one from which it emanates, as can be seen in the tales of Poe, in The Picture of Dorian Gray, and in the story told by Marcel Schwab. Thus, the girl condemns her mother to death by becoming a woman, and yet she permits her to survive. The mother's behavior depends on whether she grasps her child's healthy development as a promise of ruin or of resurrection. Many mothers become rigid in hostility. They do not accept being supplanted by the ingrate who owes them her life. We have often pointed out the coquette's jealousy of the fresh adolescent who denounces her artifices. A woman who has detested a rival in any woman will hate the rival even in her child. She sends her away, hides her, or finds ways to deprive her of opportunities. A woman who took pride in being the wife and the mother in an exemplary and unique way will refuse no less fiercely to give up her throne. She continues to affirm that her daughter is merely a child, and she considers her undertakings to be childish games. She is too young to marry, too delicate to give birth. If she insists on wanting a husband, a home, and children, they will never be more than lookalikes. The mother tirelessly criticizes, derides, or prophesies misfortune. If she can, she condemns her daughter to eternal childhood. If not, she tries to ruin this adult life the daughter is trying to lead on her own. We have seen that she often succeeds. Many young women remain sterile, have miscarriages, prove incapable of nursing and raising their children, or running their homes because of this evil influence. Their conjugal life becomes impossible. Unhappy and isolated, they will find refuge in the sovereign arms of their mothers. If they resist her, a perpetual conflict will pit them against each other. The frustrated mother largely transfers onto her son-in-law the irritation her insolent daughter's independence provokes in her. The mother who passionately identifies with her daughter is no less tyrannical. What she wants, having acquired mature experience, is to relive her youth. Thus will she save her past while saving herself from it. She herself will choose a son-in-law who conforms to the perfect husband she never had. Flirtatious and tender, she will easily imagine somewhere in her heart that it is she he is marrying. Through her daughter, she will satisfy her old desires for wealth, success, and glory. Such women, who ardently push their children along the paths of seduction, cinema, or theater, have often been described. Under the pretext of watching over them, they take over their lives. I have been told about some who go so far as to take the girl's suitor to bed with them. But it is rare for the girl to put up with this guardianship indefinitely. The day she finds a husband or a serious protector, she will rebel. The mother-in-law who had begun by cherishing her son-in-law then becomes hostile to him. She moans about human ingratitude, takes the role of victim herself. she becomes, in her turn, an enemy mother. Foreseeing these disappointments, many women feign indifference when they see their children grow up, but they take little joy from it. A mother must have a rare mixture of generosity and detachment to find enrichment in her children's lives without becoming a tyrant or turning them into her tormentors. The grandmother's feelings toward her grandchildren are an extension of those she has for her daughter. She often transfers her hostility onto them. It is not only out of fear of public opinion that so many women force their seduced daughter to have an abortion, to abandon the child, to do away with it. They are only too happy to keep her for motherhood. They obstinately wish to keep the privilege for themselves. They readily advise even a legitimate mother to provoke a miscarriage, not to breastfeed the child, or to rid herself of it. They themselves will deny the existence of this impudent little being by their indifference, or else they will spend their time endlessly scolding the child, punishing him, even mistreating him. By contrast, the mother who identifies with her daughter often welcomes the children more avidly than the young woman does. The daughter is disconcerted by the arrival of the little stranger. The grandmother recognizes him. She goes back 20 years in time. She becomes the young woman giving birth again. All the joys of possession and domination her children long ago ceased to give her are returned to her. All the desires of motherhood she had renounced with menopause are miraculously fulfilled. She is the real mother. She takes charge of the baby with authority, and if the baby is given over to her, she will passionately devote herself to him. Unfortunately for her, the young woman is keen to hold on to her rights. The grandmother is authorized only to play the role of assistant that her elders formerly played with her. She feels dethroned. And besides, she has to share this with her son-in-law's mother, of whom she is naturally jealous. Resentment often distorts the spontaneous love she felt at first for the child. The anxiety often observed in grandmothers expresses the ambivalence of their feelings. They cherish the baby insofar as it belongs to them. They are hostile to the little stranger.